ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The regimes clung to power for almost half a century, but what true believer would fight today for the Islamic Republic of Iran? This is the Religion and Ethics Report. Hello there, Andrew West with you on ABC Radio National, ABC Listen, and across the Pacific on Radio Australia. And later, the man trying to hold together Australia's divided Anglican Church. Iran finds itself again on the brink of conflict with the West. The latest tension follows mass demonstrations and mass killings of protesters. So how long can the 47-year-old theocratic regime survive? Dr. Kylie Moore-Gilbert of Macquarie University specialises in the Middle East. She spent almost 3 years as a political prisoner in the regime's jails. Kylie, what's different about this recent turmoil?
There are two factors here that are manifestly different to the Woman Life Freedom Movement of 2022 and into 2023. And they both involve the regime rather than the protesters themselves. The first is that the regime is in a much weaker and more vulnerable state than it was in 2022. And the second is the response of the regime to the protesters. So they used live fire, they used military-grade weapons against unarmed, civilian, peaceful protesters on the streets, where we've seen death toll estimates above 30,000 dead in a period of around 48 hours alone, which is just shocking. We obviously didn't see that in 22 with the Woman Life Freedom Movement. I think a few over maybe 500 died, and that was over many months, not over a few days. So the death toll, you know, shows that the approach of the regime was manifestly different this time around. Mm. And that goes to my first point. They're weak, they're vulnerable, particularly in light of the 12-day war with Israel that occurred last year. They don't have control over their own skies anymore. They don't have air defences to put paid to any further bombing campaigns by the US or Israel, for instance. And they've been penetrated, and that's been shown to the very highest echelons of the regime. I mean, some of those assassinations that occurred during that war were just striking. You know, the head of the IRGC's intelligence organization was taken out. That's like having intelligence to take out the head of the CIA. I mean, that's amazing. Some of these generals and some of these top officials would have been thought to have been untouchable. That the level of vulnerability and the utterly extreme and barbaric response, I think, is what marks these protests as different.
Do you think the Ayatollah Khamenei and the others, do you think they understand their vulnerability?
I think they understand their vulnerability, and they've made the decision to go full Bashar al-Assad on the internal unrest. I mean, they essentially helped Assad write the playbook that he enacted in the Syrian civil war, which was just, we will kill however many of our citizens we need to kill to stay in power. We don't care what the death toll is, and we don't care whether we destroy our own country in the course of doing that. And it worked for Assad up until less than 2 weeks, when he just suddenly fell following the weakening of Hezbollah. It worked for years for Assad, and maybe they think that it will work for them too. But the toll that this will take on the country, I don't even think they've fully comprehended at this point.
Mm. The face that Iran presents to the world is a theocracy. It insists it's some sort of democracy guided by Islamic principles and Sharia law. But I'm wondering, Kylie, about the extent to which it's simply become another autocratic regime, you know, staying in power to preserve its own privileges rather than any religious vision. Is it authentically still an Islamic republic?
I think you can quibble over whether it was ever authentically Islamic. Certainly when it comes to Shia religious theology, Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic, the leader of the revolutionary movement in 79, and he was an Ayatollah and respected as one of the Marja Taqlids, the core top Ayatollahs in the Shia world at the time. The theological foundations upon which he built this ethos of Islamic Republic were always a little bit dodgy and involved quite a stretch in terms of the religious justifications for clerical rule. But at least he had those credentials. Ayatollah Khamenei's successor did not have those religious credentials. He was not Marja Taqlid. He wasn't even an Ayatollah at the point that he was elevated to supreme leader. So even that has sort of gone out the window, and the religious veneer that was holding together this regime's ideology is even more wobbly today. That being said, you can't deny the Islamic character of the regime. And while there are a lot of grifters and a lot of opportunists who have sort of attached themselves to groups like the IRGC to advance themselves and might be just saying they're religious or going along with it, not out of conviction, but, you know, out of benefit to themselves, there is a sizable cohort of deeply religious pro-regime, both supporters and members of the regime, and that worldview still drives their decision-making. So you can't kind of divorce it entirely from Islam, but at the same time, they're very much perverted aspects of both Shia religious theology and the way in which an Islamic entity is meant to govern itself, you know, under principles of justice and fairness, equality. These kinds of principles are not arguably adhered to by the Islamic Republic by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned there, Kylie, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, the IRGC. And I should remind the listeners, you had your own exposure to them when you were a political prisoner in Iran not so long ago. But the IRGC, to which you referred, it was certainly born out of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. But these days, as I've been reading about it, it seems heavily invested in business and money making. Does that complicate or does that compromise its willingness to defend the revolution in a way if its preoccupation is making money?
I don't think we've seen that conflict of interest emerge yet within the Islamic Republic, probably because it sees itself as the revolution. I mean, not only is the IRGC the defender of the revolution and its achievements, but it has become the state. We've seen the IRGC factions within the broader regime kind of take over most of the other factions and most of the other aspects of the regime where they used to exist in more of a balance in the past. It's very difficult to separate the IRGC itself and its money-making enterprises, and it operates a bit like a mafia in many, many sectors of the economy. It's very difficult to separate that from the broader regime and the outcome of the revolution itself, particularly given that they report directly to the supreme leader, Khamenei, and he is a hardliner like they are. They're just so closely welded together that conflicts of interest along those lines have not emerged. Could they emerge in the future? Maybe. I mean, we'll see what happens if and when Khamenei either passes away or is removed, and he's 86 years old, so he doesn't have much of a natural lifespan left to him regardless of what happens next. There is a universe in which you could see IRGC elements potentially be in conflict with some of the clerical elements, depending who or what group tries to take power after Khamenei. But for now, they've been so closely welded together almost that the interests of both the regime and the IRGC have been inseparable.
Yeah, the reason I'm so interested in your insights into this, Kylie, and the reason I'm fascinated about the possible weakening of the religious impulse, even marginally inside the regime, is that I wonder, in the event of the regime really being pushed to the brink, what would they be fighting for? Who would give their lives to defend the Ayatollahs?
I don't think they're fighting for the Ayatollahs. And by the Ayatollahs, really, we're talking about Khamenei. And while members of the IRGC certainly look to him as their religious inspiration, they're fighting for their own skins and their own financial interests. They want to maintain the system because they're benefiting richly from that system, and it's all about staying in power. There's an excellent observer of Iran, commentator on Iran in the US called Karim Sajjadpour, and he often quotes an Iranian professor friend of his who said that when the revolution started out in 1979, the Islamist revolutionaries were 80% true believers and 20% charlatans. And now that figure has reversed itself. So you've only got 20% true believers and 80% charlatans, but those true believers are still there and they are still very much part of that cause and believe firmly in the ideological underpinnings of the Islamic Republic as an institution and a structure and a way of life within Iran as well. But, you know, that 80%, and many of them are IRGC, many of them are the guys with the guns and the guys with the financial incentives to keep the current structure as is. They have a lot to lose should the Islamic Republic fall and a lot to gain if it remains in place. Irrespective of its religious character, I think they'll seek to maintain it for that reason.
And here on the Religion and Ethics Report with me, Andrew West, I'm speaking with Dr. Kylie Moore-Gilbert. She's from Macquarie University. She's a senior research fellow in the School of International Studies, and she's an expert on modern Iran. What do we know about the resistance? Has it turned en bloc against the idea of an Islamic Republic?
Absolutely. There is no opposition group, of which there are many in the diaspora or inside Iran, that wants an Islamic Republic. There was a sort of a move to reform the Islamic Republic from within, and we saw that in the 2009 Green Movement, where you had protests on the streets against a stolen election, where you had calls for so-called moderate reform-minded factions of the regime to take power. Any belief in those guys has long since dissipated. The resounding call on the streets and within every opposition movement is for the regime wholesale to go.
Is there an objective beyond getting rid of this dictatorial regime among this diverse resistance?
In a way, it's kind of a reverse mirror sort of image of 79, the situation we're seeing emerge right now. There are a variety of groups inside and outside the country. All of them, as in 79, want the removal of the current regime ruling the country, but they're not necessarily united in the exact form of government they would like to see instituted in Iran after that. They all want broad values like freedom, like democracy, human rights, the ability for the Iranian people to choose the kind of government that governs them. And I would say most of these groups, all of these groups, can agree on those very, very broad principles, but they can't even agree on leadership or who should belong in a council of a group of a variety of different leaders. They can't even agree on that. So this is one of the core problems that is to the regime's advantage, in that there is not a unified opposition opposing them, and that the regime itself has actually been engaged in divide and conquer tactics for decades now amongst the various opposition groups, and they've been very effective at that as well. So it's a sort of a leaderless opposition, or led by a variety of different groups with a variety of different leaders. That lack of unity is a real, real problem if and when the regime should fall, and that it'll lead to a vacuum, and good things don't necessarily happen in such a vacuum. So there have been many calls for the opposition to unite, but so far they haven't been effective.
Yeah, the son of the late Shah, he seems very popular among the resistance. And I think it's something like 75 to 80% of Iranians were born after 1979. Would he be returning as a constitutional monarch? Would he be returning at all? Or would he simply be a kind of Emanos Gries guiding a new Iran?
I think Reza Pahlavi would like to play that role and would like to position himself as such a figure, but he is not the unified opposition leader that people are searching for. He is very popular in the diaspora, and the monarchists are very loud. They are dominating most of the protest rallies, including here in Australia. They are one of the most organized groups in the opposition outside of Iran, but they're not organized inside Iran. His level of support inside Iran has long estimated to be very, very weak, in the single digits. Certainly, he's had a boost of support inside the country in the past couple of years. And in these protests in January, we've seen his name chanted in the streets in certain areas. But we don't actually know what level of support he has inside the country. Historically, it's been minimal, because a lot of supporters of the former Shah, of his father, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, fled Iran in 1979, and they took their assets, some of them with them, or they fled for their lives and had to start afresh abroad. And that's why you have so many supporters of the Shah and the monarchy living in Western countries who are organized right now. But that doesn't necessarily reflect the voting preferences of those who remained inside Iran. Yeah. And, you know, the Shah is a divisive character for especially ethnic and religious minority groups in Iran, of which they're almost, you know, around 50% of the population, actually. His grandfather, Reza Shah, presided over very brutal policies towards some of these ethnic minority groups, like the Kurds, for example. And I don't think many of them would be happy to see a reinstallation of the monarchy.
What is the moral obligation of the West, and frankly, specifically the United States, when it comes to the resistance in Iran?
I don't think the West necessarily has a moral obligation to militarily intervene in Iran or something like that, despite the fact that this is being called for by multiple sources inside and outside the country. However, Trump's Truth Social posts of January, of which there were, I think, four or five, plus off-the-cuff comments he's made in various media interviews during this protest movement, encouraging people to take to the streets, saying help is on its way, we're locked and loaded and ready to go. If Iran should execute protesters, he's going to come in militarily, making all kinds of quite forceful and radical remarks to encourage these protesters. That kind of gave him a moral obligation to do something. The fact that he has so far done nothing, and that while these protests were hot, while they were happening, while tens of thousands of innocent people were getting gunned down in the streets, Trump did not intervene. He did not save these people, and he didn't do anything, despite promising the opposite on social media. That has created something of a moral obligation for Trump personally, in my view. And a lot of people are feeling very let down. Yeah. Inside Iran in particular by him.
Yeah, you've in fact raised some questions about the wisdom of foreign and specifically US intervention in Iran. What are those concerns? What are they based on?
You don't know what could happen as a result, right? It's an extremely fraught and risky decision to make. You can't bomb the regime from the air into non-existence. It's dug in, it's under control. It has a monopoly on violence. It's in control of all of its territories and borders. They are the only guys with the guns so far. You can't just strategically bomb a few sites and hope they're going to go away. They're not going anywhere. So what effect will it actually have? And will it potentially backfire in some way? It's hard to know. It's all very unpredictable. The US doesn't have a great track record of military intervention in other parts of the Middle East. Absent some kind of grand strategy, or absent doing it in partnership with groups on the ground who are attempting to remove the regime organically, domestically, via other means, I just don't see what use it could necessarily serve. And there is a lot of potential there for it to backfire. I think the time has passed for intervention, and they need to explore other methods of encouraging the Iranian people to remove this brutal dictatorship themselves.
Dr. Kylie Moore-Gilbert, she's now a research fellow at the School of International Studies at Macquarie University. You heard me refer earlier to Kylie's time as a political prisoner in Iran. She documented it in her book, The Uncaged Sky, My 804 Days in an Iranian Prison. We'll put a link to that at our website. Kylie, thank you for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you're on ABC Radio National with me, Andrew West. The world's 85 million Anglicans have a new spiritual leader. Dame Sarah Mullally has officially started work as Archbishop of Canterbury, the first woman to hold the job. But this historic appointment has sharpened divisions. In Africa and Australia, some conservative Anglicans reject her leadership. Bishop Mark Short of the Canberra Goulburn Diocese is the new primate of the Anglican Church of Australia.
As someone who's very recently settled into a primatial role, I want to assure her of our prayers as she assumes some very weighty and complex responsibilities. The Anglican Church of Australia values the heritage we share with the Church of England. So we share a rich history of ministry and mission, and we will be praying for Archbishop Sarah as she takes her place in that heritage.
You referred there to weighty issues that she will have to deal with.
Firstly, there's just the complexity of the role. She is, at the same time, the diocesan bishop of Canterbury. She's the primate of England, and she's also has a key role in the Worldwide Anglican Communion. Of course, in the Worldwide Anglican Communion, there are both the blessings of shared fellowship, but also the challenges that have come to that fellowship, particularly through disagreements over how we're to respond faithfully to issues of human sexuality. Mm. So I think one of the challenges and opportunities for Archbishop Sarah will be to lead us in an honest and open conversation about where we are, so that in naming where we are, we might find the best way forward.
Yeah. You're the primate of the church in Australia, the leader of Australia's Anglican bishops. Are you, Mark, in a position to guarantee to Archbishop Sarah Mullally the loyalty of Australian Anglican clergy?
Well, no Australian Anglican clergy take an oath of loyalty to the Archbishop of Canterbury. Hers is an office that we respect and pray for, and I have every expectation that we'll continue to do so.
The reason I ask that is that the biggest and most powerful diocese in Australia, the Sydney Anglican Diocese, reacted to her appointment in this way. Her public comments show that she has strayed from the clear teaching of Scripture and promoted serious error that will neither advance unity nor the mission of the Church. It said that successive Anglican archbishops have forfeited the trust of Orthodox Anglicans who now look to other leaders. It doesn't sound like your fellow bishops or your colleagues in the Sydney Diocese feel any affinity or loyalty towards the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Certainly, I'm aware that behind those comments lie some of those, you know, significant disagreements I've referred to earlier. The Diocese of Sydney continues to be part of the Anglican Church of Australia. The Anglican Church of Australia is in turn in communion with the Church of England. So there is a relationship there. Like all relationships, it has its moments of challenge. It has its times when we need to speak honestly and openly about areas of disagreement as well as agreement. And I'm hoping that we will have that kind of relationship moving forward.
Should Archbishop Sarah set foot in Australia, would she be received as the Archbishop of Canterbury by all the Anglican bishops? There are some who don't even recognise her as a priest.
Of course, as is always the case, that decision would rest with the bishops of individual dioceses. Certainly, in my role as primate, she'd be very welcome, including here in the Anglican Diocese of Canberra-Goulburn.
Now, I know that you are personally very committed to unity. You are dealing with a very fractious Anglican church here in Australia. I mean, how do you keep the show together? You've only just started your role as primate. You've got bishops from very different dioceses. In Perth, for example, Archbishop Kay identifies probably quite strongly as a liberal Anglican. In Sydney, they don't even recognise the Archbishop of Canterbury, Sarah Mullally, as a priest. How do you keep this show together?
By recognising that it's not primarily my responsibility to do so. I wrote something when it was announced that Bishop Sarah was taking on this role, probably in light of my reflections on my new responsibilities. And one of the things I said there is that when it comes to senior ecclesiastical roles, increasingly we tend to see them through the lens of, you know, managing difference. My lodestar for my particular role, and I assume it is Bishop Sarah's as well, is to go back to the ordinal, which talks about bearing witness to Christ's resurrection, proclaiming the truth of the gospel, discerning the mind of Christ, commitment to the scriptures. And yes, that needs to work itself out in relationships. But my view, it's as we speak the truth in love, that we'll be in a much better position to do so. That's how I see my calling primarily. Of course, that involves a call to guard the unity that we're given in Jesus. My sense is, both for Archbishop Sarah and myself, if we end up seeing ourselves primarily as a manager of difference, we'll end up failing in that particular calling and perhaps missing out on much more important ones.
The Sydney Anglican leadership says that Archbishop Sarah Mullally supports abortion rights and the blessing of same-sex relationships. Now, she doesn't necessarily support the Anglican Church conducting same-sex weddings, but they say she supports the blessing of same-sex relationships. How can that be reconciled with the position not just of the Sydney Anglicans, but perhaps a majority of the global South Anglicans? Because in Africa, the leader of the church in Nigeria, which is the biggest single bloc in the Anglican Communion, has said, we don't even recognise the Archbishop of Canterbury as our leader anymore. We're not sending them money. We're not going to take directions or take any leadership from them. Where is this position of reconciliation going to come from?
I mean, the issues you raise are serious ones. When it comes to the blessing of same-sex unions, I don't see matters the same way as I understand Archbishop Serra sees them. The last time that General Synod met, we had the opportunity to vote on the statement affirming that the Church's understanding of teaching that marriage is between a man and a woman, and consequently stating that it's not appropriate to have authorised blessings of same-sex unions, and I voted in favour of that statement. So yes, there's areas where I do disagree with her. I think part of the way forward for the Anglican Communion is noting and being honest about those disagreements and recognising that while it may lead to a loosening of bonds, if there's honesty about that, it may be that bonds can be maintained, albeit in a different form to the case 50 or 100 years ago. Leaving aside disputes over sexuality, the Anglican Communion of today is much different from 100 years ago. We've seen the huge shifting in gravity and numbers towards the global south, the rise of leaders from the global south, missionary movements from the global south to the global north. Those changes in and of themselves would have significant implications for our life together as a communion. You know, I know one of Bishop Serra's key roles will be to interact with some proposals that have come out from the Inter-Anglican Standing Commission on Faith and Order, so-called Nairobi-Cairo proposals, that talk about ways in which it might be possible both to be honest about our disagreements, to recognise the way in which those disagreements have had an impact on the nature of our relationships, to affirm the growing input of leadership from different parts of the communion, and nevertheless chart a way forward in light of all that.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but is it not the case that to still call yourself an Anglican in Australia, with all the privileges, the access to property, the access to the name itself, you are required to be in communion with the See of Canterbury? What then happens if any diocese in Australia, objecting to Archbishop Serra Mullally's perceived liberalism on human sexuality, says, we're not in communion with Canterbury? What then happens to the Church? What happens to those dioceses?
Well, they would still be a part of the Anglican Church of Australia, which is in itself in communion with the Church of England according to its constitution. That would continue to be the case. There's legal questions beyond that, which are probably above my pay grade at this stage. The basic reality that, you know, we have 23 Anglican dioceses that make up the Anglican Church of Australia. I have every confidence that none of them is intending to go anywhere.
And they've told you that?
As I speak to a variety of bishops around the country of a variety of different views, they all affirm their commitment to remaining part of the Anglican Church of Australia.
Bishop Mark Short, he's the Anglican Bishop of the Diocese of Canberra-Goulburn, but he is also the Primate of the Anglican Church in Australia, the leading bishop among Australian Anglicans. Thanks for being with us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you, Andrew.
And before we leave you, I'm sad to report the tragically premature death from cancer of a frequent guest on this show. John Allen was a truly distinguished writer on the Catholic world. He had extraordinary insights and contacts in the Vatican, which he used to enlighten us all. John and his wife Elise publish the news site Crux Now. It will continue. John Allen was just 61. That's it for this episode. You can follow us at ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to producer Mandy Roberts and Simon Branthwaite. I'm Andrew West. Join us again for the Religion and Ethics Report.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.